1034, Senator Lori, the Omnibus Health and Human Service Bill. Senator Cohen moves that Senate File 1034 be re-referred to Finance without recommendation. Questions? All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senate File 1057 by Dietzick, the Omnibus Jobs and Economic Development Appropriations Bill. That has some policy provisions in it, so that needs to go to Senator Sparks' committee. So Senator Pappas moves Senate File 1057 be re-referred to the Jobs, Ag, and Rural Development Committee without recommendation. Discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Senator Saxog has Senate File 1154, the Omnibus State Government, Military Affairs, and Veteran Affairs Appropriations. Senator Cohen moves that Senate File 1154 be re-referred to Finance without recommendation. Discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senate File 1170. Senator Metzen moves Senate File 1170 by Thomasoni, the Omnibus Environment, Natural Resources, and Commerce Bill be re-referred to Finance without recommendation. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senate File 1051. Senator Cohen moves Senate File 1051, the Clean Water Fund and Parks and Trails Fund appropriations be re-referred to Finance without recommendation. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
Crazy.
Senator Pappas, Senate File 359.
Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 359 would designate April as Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month. And you can see the text, it's fairly simple. Beginning in 2013, the month of April is designated as Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month in recognition of the state's desire to combat all acts of genocide and all human rights atrocities. The state of Minnesota has a history of standing up against genocide. In 2007, Governor Pawlenty signed into law a bill that divested our state public pension funds from companies that were directly or indirectly funding the genocide in Darfur. Minnesotans didn't want to be complicit in that genocide. In 2011, a resolution was unanimously passed in the House and Senate declaring April to be Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month. And in April 2012, we received a certificate of recognition from Governor Dayton recognizing the efforts of World Without Genocide to educate the public about genocide and to commemorate the victims of genocide. And I hope today to make this recognition permanent through the passage of this bill. The reason April was chosen for this important designation is it's a month in which the anniversaries of six of these tragedies occurred. April 3rd was the Darfur genocide. April 5th was the anniversary of the siege of Sarajevo, Bosnia. April 7th was the Rwanda genocide is the Rwanda Genocide Remembrance Day. April 8th is the Holocaust Remembrance Day. April 17th is the anniversary of the Cambodian genocide. Mr. Chairman, you know, the rest of the text is kind of there if people are interested in reading it, but unless there's any questions, I would just move that Senate File 359 be recommended to pass.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, recommended to pass and go where? To the floor?
To the floor. Any other discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you.
I think I see Senator Rest. Members, we have two bills related to campaign finance. Senator Eakin has Senate File 496. Senator Rest has 661. So let's start with Senator Rest. Senate File 661.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 661 is a bill that comes to us through the Campaign Finance Board, and it addresses issues of disclosure and then also contribution limits, spending limits, et cetera, for those who take public financing. The 661 combines another bill, which is Senator Eakin's bill. In 661, it's the second article. It's the technical bill. We just put them together. His bill is traveling separately, but it's also Article 2 of 661. The just as a background about the board, and then I have a suggestion for one additional amendment to delete some language that we have found to be vague and not necessary, and I'll bring that up in just a minute. But just so people know, I know that Senator Newman and Senator Limmer and Senator Cohen have gone through the two very extensive hearings in the election subcommittee on the bill. But the Campaign Finance Board is a board made up of six people who are appointed by the governor. They all have to be confirmed by both the House and the Senate. It is the only gubernatorial appointments which have to be confirmed by the House in addition to the Senate, and the bar is higher than it is for the confirmation of the governor's appointees and other agencies. They have to be confirmed by 3/5 of the 60% of the members, which means that in general there would be bipartisan support for them. They have to be it's six people. Two of them have to be former legislators, one a Democrat, one a Republican. Two have to be people without any partisan history other than attending something like a precinct caucus. And the other two would be a Republican and a Democrat. No more than three members must be of a single political party. So it's six people. So when they make decisions, they have to do it with coming out of either nonpartisan or no partisan domination of the board. No lobbyists can be a member of the board, and they elect their own chair. The current chair is Andy Lueger. The bill that you have in front of you sets up some policy changes and starts out with setting up a ballot question political committee and a ballot question political fund, and indicates it throughout how they would operate and the disclosures that they would be required to make. Same thing is true, setting up the parameters under which disclosures need to be made by the Independent Expenditure Committees, and also goes on to define electioneering materials, and then gets into the increases, setting up a different way in which campaigns raise their money, not when they report it, but raise their money and spend their money, and instead of doing it annually, proposes to do it through election cycles. So for the Senate, in a 10-year period, there would be three election cycles, 2 4-year cycles and 1 2-year cycle. For the members of the House, they would have 5 2-year cycles, or their election cycle would always be 2 years. And for the gubernatorial and the constitutional officers, their election cycles would be 4 years. And, of course, this does not pertain at all to the federal offices because they are controlled by the Federal Elections Commission and law. That's the general overview of what's in the bill. And on page, Mr. Chairman, I think you have the, I hope Mr. Bodden has the CE2 amendment.
But, Senator Ress, we need to adopt the committee report first before we can amend it. Senator Skoy moves the committee engrossment SS0661CE just to get the bill in shape so that it, Senator Ress can then offer her amendment. On the Skoy motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. No, motion prevails. The committee report as amended into the Senate file is now in front of us, Senator Ress.
Mr. Chairman, the CE2 amendment just delivers some language that we think is unnecessarily vague, and it deals with the sections on electioneering communications. So it's on page 17 to delete lines 11 through 16.
17. And Senator Ress, the reason?
Mr. Chairman, we just felt, and you know, it's a constant discussion about this bill, and trying to make sure that it's clear, and that the parameters are well set, and the this particular paragraph was felt in those discussions to be unnecessarily vague, and not very helpful to those that are engaged in electioneering communications. So we just think it should be deleted.
Mr. Goldsmith, any thoughts on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Yes, the board supports this amendment. This came about as a result of many conversations I had with typically 501c4 interest groups, and one of the representatives of one of those groups pointed out that this would be difficult to interpret and enforce and probably not necessary at this point, and I agreed with her, and as a result, we recommend this provision be removed, and that actually then narrows the definition of electioneering communication.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, are we going to have a more detailed explanation of the bill? I understand that Senator Ress gave us a very high-level kind of review of it, but you know, we're starting to adapt amendments and being told this should be taken out, and we haven't gotten a really good explanation of what's going on in this bill.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, we certainly can go through the bill section by section. I wasn't sure. This is like the first time, it's my experience, the Rules Committee has sits as a policy committee. With a subcommittee coming forward, and I didn't know the level of detail wanted presented. But we can certainly go through it section by section if you like.
Senator Fischbach, though, would you like? I just assumed we would do that in the election committee, but we, Senator Fischbach would like to
see. And we have had two very lengthy hearings on it and made a lot of amendments and so forth, but if that would be helpful to you, we can certainly do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, this is the first time I've seen it. So, and the elections committee is a subcommittee. My understanding is a subcommittee of this committee, and we are the committee of the original jurisdiction concerned with the policy. So I think that we should have some, at least, explanation and understanding of what's going on, and particularly when we are being asked to adopt amendments. I mean, either we work on it or we don't, and when we're adapting amendments, then it's obvious that we should be doing a little more explanation than that.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, we can start with a section-by-section description of the bill. And let me go back to mine.
And members, there is a bill summary in your packet.
Section 1.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rest, are you going to be working off of the 1CE document?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Senator Rest.
I'm going to be referring to something else, but it'll be that document. In the first section, the ballot question political committee is defined. Section 2 defines a ballot question political fund. Section 3 is a technical fix. There was an incorrect reference there. Section 4 defines a contribution, in particular that an allocation by an association of a general treasury money is deemed a contribution. Section 5, which where we had a lot of discussion in the elections subcommittee, is a definition of expressly advocating, which sets up a reasonable person standard so that the board, when a complaint is made that express advocacy has occurred, they have to use a reasonable person standard, which would say that no other possible interpretation by a reasonable person could be reached other than it was expressly advocating. This is different. We have used in the past words like vote for or support or whatever. This uses a standard that is part of the Supreme Court opinion and written by Justice Roberts. It's his language in that opinion of the Wisconsin Right to Life versus the FEC? Versus the FEC. Section 6 is, again, a definitional section of what general treasury money means. Section 7 is a definition of person. Section 8, a definition of a political committee, and that's just expanded a bit because right now, it in current law, it talks about support for a candidate, and we know that on occasion political committees support more than one candidate. So we're just accommodating one or more rather than saying just a candidate. And it is fairly technical there. Section 9 is the definition of political fund. Section 10 is a technical change to be a technical section to be consistent with a change that comes up in Section 12. Section 11 addresses the authority of the board to make audits and investigations, imposing statutory civil penalties and issuing orders for compliance. Section 12 talks about the authority of the board with regard to violations. Right now, the board conducts its violations under conducts its investigations under Section 10A, and this also allows them to do what in fact actually happens, and that is brings in the statute to 211B. Into their authority. They already do this. This is making it explicit that they may conduct investigations under that section of the statute. In lines, probably it's 19 through 22, this makes it a very narrow and we believe very fair application for their investigatory powers. And that goes on. Section 14 sets up the penalty for false statements, and Mr. Chairman, you'll see there's a number of times when we're addressing sections where it is penalties or whatever, and sets up what a violation may be. And so that is what will occasion the bill, if it's acted on favorably, to be referred to the Judiciary Committee for its next step for review. Section 15 also sets up a penalty with regard to record keeping. Section 16 sets up and is far more generous than we have been in the past. What triggers the what actions triggers someone being required to file a committee? And right now, I think we all know it's $100. And we are, the board is suggesting, when I say we, it's the board, are suggesting that that be raised to a reasonable, much more reasonable amount of $750. And that's the same thing for a candidate as well. You probably can imagine if someone is wants to run, let's say, for the legislature, and they testing the waters, maybe at the precinct caucuses and handing out something at the precinct caucuses, that in this day and age, that can very likely cost more than $100 to do that. And if they weren't successful or decided to bow out, they wouldn't have to file a committee because they had spent $115 on printing. They'd have to be more than $750. And that continues through we're setting different limits. Again, they're more generous than they have been in the past for the very same reasons with regard to when an association has to file, if they're a ballot question organization or whether they are an independent expenditure group. And we are setting that limit at $1,500. Again, right now it's $100. Or for an independent expenditure committee and $5,000 for a ballot question group. Section 19 indicates that there can be no commingling of the fund. Funds, Section 20 goes into the permitted disbursements for independent expenditure political committees or, making them the same, a ballot question political committee or fund. And then this is what they can do, and that is what is stated throughout the rest of that, the additional things. Section 21, once again, sets the bar at $750 before a first registration has to occur for a political committee or et cetera. Then in Section 22, there are the processes with filing with the board for independent expenditure or ballot question political committees. In Section 23, we're raising the limit for reporting of anonymous contributions from $20 to $50. As you know, if you receive an anonymous contribution above $20, you are required to send it in to the Campaign Finance Board, and then it is deposited. It's not kept by the board. It is deposited into the general fund, and in particular, the general account of the State Elections Campaign Fund, which is where we fund the public subsidies to for candidates. Section 24 also that is setting in the same thing, a $50 maximum. Section 25 has caused some campaigns. There have been some confusion and about the period of time to send back a contribution that was made that needs to be returned, and it just merely extends that period from 60 days to 90 days. Section 26, again, is referencing the first filing of a committee. 27 indicates the time that you must file and the number of reports that must be made. Section 28 gives the contents of the report and adds, if you look at line 30, right now you have to report the information about an individual who gives you more than or an entity that gives you more than $100, and this moves that to $200 as the bar over which you must make that report. Some people, of course, list everybody who gives them anything, but they're not required to do that. And right now, it's only those contributions in excess of $100. That applies to all of these groups as well. Section 29 deals with the pre-election reports, and as now, a political fund, if they get it from any one source more than $1,000, they have to report. And I think we changed that. This is the 24. This refers to the 24-hour rule. You know, 24 within a certain period of time after a report is the cutoff date for a report. If you get big contributions, you need to send in what amounts to an affidavit of the receipt of an additional contribution that exceeds any general amount, and that's what is listed here. And for the different levels of offices, section 30 also deals with what happens if you didn't have a formal committee, and again sets that level at $750 rather than currently $100. Section 31 is kind of a little bit of a loosening. If you didn't have any activity, then you're not required to keep on filing a no activity return, and you can either do that on your own part, or the board can initiate that as well. And that's covered in per political funds under Section 32. Section 33 gets into the electioneering communications, and these communications now are defined, and they something becomes an electioneering communication when it is when that communication occurs within 30 days of primary and 60 days of the general election. It in no way inhibits those communications being made. It just states that they are how they are to be characterized for purposes of disclosure. And the made some changes in the election subcommittee. Was that yesterday? Yesterday. And these days, sometimes it seems like a month ago, and it's like, was it just yesterday? I guess it was. In particular, paying attention to things that are sent out that are voter guides, that we want to specifically indicate that that's not considered an electioneering communication except under certain circumstances, and that there are grace periods. And for example, one of the changes we made is that if we at some point move to a June primary, what's proposed originally was that you can't do this when the legislature is in session, and you can't do it. It would be considered an electioneering communication if it was in 30 days of primary. But those voter guides are often sent out at the end of the session. And so there's a grace period of 10 days following the end of a regular session, even if that would be within 30 days of the primary. We also specified that these are not the casual kinds of handouts that you find at the county fair or at some group meeting or whatever, but they really do apply when they are sent by U.S. mail or they're done in something like a door knocking, going door to door, or a lit drop. So that deals with the electioneering communications. We also raised the bar there to make it more similar to the other kinds of committees that are out there. And we raised it from $1,000 to $5,000. And I would draw your attention to Subdivision 7 there, which where it requires, just like for us, a statement of attribution, something that most of us call a disclaimer. We kept the limits for the penalties for failure to file at $50 and $1,000, at a civil penalty that would be imposed of $1,000, not $10,000, which was in the original bill. We also added a higher standard in the subcommittee to indicate that an association that makes electioneering communications and fails to file, that they must have done so willfully. That is, they not only knew they knew it was wrong, but they did it anyway. And that would be a finding that would have to be done. Section 34 is technical. Section 35 is deals with the termination of registration of committees. Section 36 deals with the again with the inactive status of political funds and how they are to either indicate a method of resuming their activities or the processes and procedures that are gone through with regard to their inactive status. Section 37 is, again, dealing with inactive funds and the actions that can be taken by the board themselves to declare a fund to be inactive. Section 38 deals with simply that because a board, a group has terminated, does not release them from any of their debts or obligations that they incurred while they were active. Section 39 deals with a change from the way we deal with raising funds now at all levels in state offices, including the legislature, from an annual cycle to an election cycle. And as I mentioned at the beginning, for the Senate, there are 2 4-year cycles and 1 2-year cycle. There are amounts that are suggested by the Campaign Finance Board. I have not made any suggestions to change them yet. I'm still in a lot of conversations about that. I think or change them from what is recommended by the board. They themselves have said that they thought that these were the lowest amounts that should be considered by the legislature. I think we need to talk more about that and if these levels are correct. Keeping in mind, if you just to understand how this works, if you just take the Senate, because that's what we're the most familiar with. Right now, in an election year, you can a campaign committee can spend approximately $70,000 on campaign expenditures. In the three non-election years, you can spend 20% of that, so you can spend $14,000. If you add up the 70 plus 3 times 14, you get $112,000 within a four-year cycle. What is set here for that four-year cycle is an amount of $120,000, which is obviously more than 112, but it is these amounts have not been changed since. It's just a cost of living adjustment in every election, and those numbers are increased for also the governor and lieutenant governor again through an election cycle, and we have set rather than minor constitutional officers, we have set attorney general, the secretary of state, and the state auditor all at the same level. The governor and lieutenant governor at one level, the next three at another level, and then the Senate and the House. We don't propose or recall any change for judges. Section 40 is technical, but I will call your attention to in E of Section 39. We've had issues before of when is a candidate really new, and when are they not new, and this. Also is going to attempt to address that. The governor and lieutenant governor in Section 41 operate as a single candidate. Section 42 just adds a reference to electioneering communication. Section 43 sets at 25% of the cycle expenditure limit of unused funds regarding unused funds, rather than 50% of the yearly one. In Section 44, contribution limits are increased at all levels for governor and lieutenant governor, and again, this is within a cycle rather than yearly. Is set at $6,000 for other constitutional officers at $4,000 for a candidate for state senator, $3,000, and right now it's that's for election cycle, and if you took what the election cycle would be annual, it would be $800, 500 plus 100, 100, 100. And so this raises the limits of of what contributions you can receive. And then similarly, but proportionately, the a candidate for state representatives moves from $600 through the cycle, 500 in an election year, 100 in a non-election year, to 1,500, and then a candidate for judicial office at 4,500. Section 45 is the amount a candidate can contribute, and we have set that at five times the candidate's election cycle contribution. Section 46 addresses definition of large contributions, which would move to be greater than $1,500. Section 47, again, raises the bar on when a contribution has to be, when it has to be reported. 48 is a technical reference. 49 is a deals with a pro rata kind of process to report contributions. Section 50 deals with the affidavit of contributions that we file. And what was happening there is that people were filing an affidavit of contributions for us to say, in our instance, to say that they had met the match, and they were counting in-kind contributions. And that, I think, is a loophole, and we this bill would insist that those contributions not be in kind. It's hard to know how you value them anyway, and the contributions must be must exclude in-kind contributions, and they must be in cash. We have not changed the bar about when you have to do that, what you have to reach. And is it within the election cycle or in the election cycle? And it is still within the 2 years that you have to raise that money preceding the election year. Section 51 is deals with complaints and that they must be filed by the, with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. And then what happens from there, if the complaint is deemed to be warranted, the matter can be referred to a county attorney. It cannot be referred to a county attorney prior to that. The board has to make a finding. And then Article 2 is just technical technical changes that are in Senator Eakin's bill. So with regard now to that, if you're interested, we can certainly wait to another committee. But we did have that suggestion coming from the 501c3s that that one section dealing with electioneering communications gets too complicated and would be very hard to administer, and so we're at their suggestion just recommending that it be that those lines be removed.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rust. Could we return briefly to Section 49 of the bill, page 29 and 30, I believe, and just trying to understand the disclosure and the changes that were made. And there's some stricken language at the bottom of page 29 and the top of page 30 in particular. And can you describe for us generally what change we're making here and what is the effect of that change?
I'm going to let Mr. Goldsmith, if that's okay with you,
sure.
Go get into the weeds here, okay?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator, and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The language that is amended by Section 49 was adopted by the legislature and signed by the governor in 2010 in response to the Citizens United case, which opened up independent expenditures to corporations and other associations that are not political committees or funds registered with the board. And it was necessary at that time to determine how they would disclose their own sources of income that they use to make these independent expenditures. There's actually a provision already in statute that they could have used. It's 10A.12 subdivision 5. However, that statute says that an association using its membership dues and fees has to disclose every donor of more than $100. And we didn't believe that that made sense or maybe even was constitutional in the context of these new associations, including nonprofit interest groups that would be making independent expenditures. So the legislature, in connection with interest groups and the Campaign Finance Board, came up with this solution. And so let me tell you what the law was before the amendment, and then I'll explain the amendment. Before the amendment, the law said you have to identify your underlying sources if you use general treasury money, which is your membership dues and fees, to make independent expenditures. And that's being expanded to ballot question expenditures as well. And the way you identify those underlying sources is to use one of three options. The first option is the underlying source can identify themselves and say, count me and list me. That never happened. The second option is for the association to pick which underlying sources it wanted to identify. And under the existing law, the threshold for itemization was $1,000. So what happened was associations would pick the first $999 from each donor. And if that was sufficient to cover all of their independent expenditures, no itemization was required. And that's the option everybody used. The third option was to prorate your independent expenditures as a percentage of your overall spending, and then to prorate your donations on the same basis. So, for example, if you spent 10% of all of your money on independent expenditures, the statute would assume that 10% of each donor's money was used, and then you would disclose only those donors for whom that 10% was more than $1,000. So here's what the amendment does. As I said, no donor has self-identified. I'm sorry, what the bill does. No donor self-identified because the association could simply pick and choose donors, and association picked and chose those donors that would result in no itemization. The bill eliminates those two options and requires proration. And the way that would work, as I've described, is if an association spends 10% of their money on independent expenditures or separately on ballot questions, they're not aggregated together, they would then apply that percentage to their donors and figure out an amount that is the attributable amount. And any donor whose attributable amount exceeds, now we've raised the amount, $5,000, would be itemized on the underlying source disclosure. And that means in that hypothetical, with 10% spending, those donors who donated more than $50,000 would be attributed as sources. This doesn't mean that the law is saying these donors gave the money specifically for that purpose, but the statute that's applicable, for example, to unions requires disclosure of money given for or used for the purpose of these expenditures. And so that's what this would do.
Senator Hatt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I, so a donor in this proposed change, or as the bill is written, would not necessarily know whether he or she, his donation would be revealed or not. That would kind of depend on the circumstances after the fact. So in making a donation, it may be revealed or it may not be revealed, sort of depending on sort of what happens at the end of the day. Is that correct?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, and members, essentially that's correct, although I think that that's not the approach that the board would take. California has taken a somewhat different approach. Their approach is to say that if the association has used money for a ballot question or independent expenditures in the last 4 years, we presume you know that some of your money will be used for that purpose. They have a much lower disclosure threshold. I think our position is that, for example, in the 10% scenario, and that's not a lot of money to use for ballot questions, if the donors, those larger donors who would be subject to itemization under a pro rata system, we would presume that they recognize what this organization has done and that some of their money is likely to be used for those purposes because those are part of the purposes of the organization. Now, they might not specifically recognize that they're going to be itemized, but large donors typically know what these organizations are doing.
And, Mr. Chair, in the course of the change that was offered, was there testimony on this in the previous committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator, testimony on the There was certainly a lot of testimony on the whole concept of changing to a strictly pro rata form of underlying source disclosure. And actually, it's as a result of those discussions, particularly with a couple of the 501c4 interest groups, that we recognized that the $1,000 threshold was, in fact, too low because it would capture far too many small donors. You'll have to recognize that with the $5,000 threshold, even if an organization used 100% of its money for independent expenditures, no donor of less of $5,000 or less would ever be disclosed. So we did want to eliminate disclosure or the potential of disclosure for those donors who are small, everyday donors who don't really think about what might happen to their money, and limit it to those donors who are more in tune with what the organization does.
Senator Lemire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest and Mr. Goldsmith, I have some concerns about our spending limits that we're talking about here. We're changing spending limits from and even donation limits. Donation limits, or let me start on the campaign limit for a Senate campaign. We currently have a limit of $68,100, and this is moving it in excess of $120,000, doubling the amount. And then the individual contribution amount is increased from $500 maximum to a $3,000 limit. And that's a 600%. Increase. I'm just wondering if you can explain, why do we have a 200% limit on our campaign expenditures for a campaign, but now increasing individual contribution limits by sixfold?
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, as I explained going through the bill, the Campaign Finance Board is recommending both expenditures and contribution limits to be based on a cycle. And so it's not a 200% increase at all. It would move actually during a campaign cycle, 4 years for a senator, from $112,000, I just rounded up to $70,000, because you get to spend $68,000 or $70,000 adjusted probably going forward in the year of the election, and then you get to spend 20% of that in each of the other 3 years for campaign expenditures, which amounts to, in a four-year cycle, $112,000. So in the campaign cycle, there is indeed an increase, but it's moving from 112 to 120. That is not a 200% increase. However, it would be the case, Senator Lemire, if you decided in that four-year cycle you weren't going to spend a dime in the 3 years prior and you wanted to spend it all in the election year. That would be up to you and your campaign. Other campaigns may decide they want to spend half of it in the year before the election. But it would be a decision that could be made by the campaign. It's not a, remember, this is a cycle now. It's not an annual report or an annual limit. And the same thing is true for the contribution limits. It is an increase, but it's within the election cycle rather than we would have rather than taking the limit that you can get from a single entity in the election year, which is higher than the limits than you can receive in the non-election year. We're trying to recognize both the increase in all kinds of costs that campaigns run into, and being able to raise the dollars to meet those campaign costs, and also that this could be some people may not like it that campaigns would be more in charge of their own destiny by controlling more of those dollars and probably being less susceptible to having their campaigns or their running for election influenced by outside groups that do independent expenditures. So I see it as a move to put campaigns a little bit more under the control of the candidate and their committee. But this is not an annual It's not just an election year limits. These are election cycle limits.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lorin.
Senator Rest, you were good enough to say who wanted it and...
The Campaign Finance Board.
What was, how
when
it was going
we,
to work.
When I say we, I'm talking on their behalf.
And I'm still a little confused about the why. Why would we want to go on a cycle? You said that it recognized real expenses throughout a term of office. Is there a contribution for public funding that goes every year during a four-year term of cycle, or is it just in the campaign year?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I don't understand your question.
I'll rephrase, Mr. Chair. A lot of candidates avail themselves of a public financing portion for their campaign. They need to raise a minimum amount of money in order to qualify for that public fund. That's just in the last 2 years preceding an election. Is that
Mr. Goldstein?
How it works?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I mentioned that going through, too, and that's not changed here.
I know, Mr. Chair, that most campaigns probably spend most of their year raising money, maybe even the year before raising money, and they wait for the last 2 or 3 months before the election itself in order to use that money to promote their candidacy. Now they'll have 4 years to raise money by a very sharp increase in availing themselves of contribution limits that are much higher than they've ever been before. And my read on this is you're going to have, with that much money that can be raised, you're going to have a much more sophisticated, much more involved campaign that we're going to start awakening in Minnesota than we've ever seen before. I think the use of television, I think the use of other advertising means will create a huge opportunity for that type of campaign tactic. I'm not necessarily sure if that's a good thing or not. Enough people are pretty tired of campaigns just on the limited scale that we now use now. And I think this is just going to open the floodgates as far as political messaging, both good and bad. And I'm just wondering why we're increasing so fast. I could see a progressive recognition of, let's say, inflation. But I can't see a 600-fold increase in a contribution limit. Not to mention the doubling of a campaign fund that I think is all going to be crushed down to the last 3 months of a campaign cycle anyway. Nobody goes out and advertises, vote for me a year or in the first year of a four-year cycle.
Mr. Chairman, au contraire. I pay for my billboards in December of the year before the election. It's called, you know, planning, and what I'm able to do is take that 20% of the campaign limit and pay for it in the year ahead of time, cash out the door. This is just saying that I wouldn't be compelled to do that in December. I could have waited until January or February. And sometimes I have to because I don't have enough money to do that. But keep in mind that, again, the campaign expenditures for senators is moving from 112 in 4 years to 120. That is not... I don't know what the percentage increase of that is, but it's, what, 10%? It's like a 10% increase. It's not a 600% increase. There is an increase in the amount of dollars you can raise, going from $500 plus $100 plus $100 plus $100, $800 in a cycle, in that four-year cycle. That is indeed being significantly increased. But I think I've heard over and over again that the $100 that senators are able to raise in the non-election years is is just too low, and it's unrealistic for them to be to have in order to have control over their campaigns and raising the money. We are raising again the point at which that contribution has to be reported from 100 to 200, and I think that also just reflects on the modern modern campaigns and just how much everything costs, and things have gone up. And you know, I don't think it's unreasonable at all.
So, Senator Limmer, I think the challenge with the current system is, in the election year, with a spending cap of $68,000 and some change, whatever it is that won't run most campaigns for a candidate. So more of the campaign-related activity gets pushed over to the independent expenditure side because candidates simply aren't allowed under the law to be able to expend the amount of money they need to communicate with the public. But I think that's the rationale with this, and I think we all admit that's probably the reality, too. Mr. Goldsmith, and back to Mr. Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I did want to make a couple of comments on contribution limits. First of all, they haven't been changed since 1993. So if they were tracking cost of living as spending limits do, $100 would be $163 today. And in 1993, they were actually rather artificially lowered, or I should say lowered on the assumption that did not play out. In 1993, the gubernatorial contribution limit was $60,000. It was 10% of the spending limit. And that year, after some back and forth efforts, Governor Carlson and the legislature agreed to a compromise bill which severely curtailed independent expenditures. You may recall that a party unit was not allowed to make an independent expenditure once it had a candidate on the ballot. And in connection with that, spending limits were lowered, or contribution limits were lowered to the levels we see today. What happened was a couple years later, the limit on independent expenditures was ruled unconstitutional. So we have then unlimited independent expenditures in a system where there are contribution limits that were based on the assumption that there would be limited independent expenditures. Senator Bach is correct. The board's observation has been that because there is money in the system that cannot be donated to candidates and cannot be used by candidates, at least those that accept public subsidy, that money goes elsewhere. And the board believes that by these increases, at least some more of that money will flow to candidates and they will have more control over their own elections. With regard to the spending limit, I commend Senator Rest for her diligence in purchasing her billboards early. However, we see other candidates who are more attempting more to game the system. For example, we have had candidates who prepay for radio time, and then I have had a candidate come back to us after the nominating convention in the election year and redistrict and find that they're not going to be a candidate and they want to get their money back from the radio station. So our philosophy is that candidates ought to be able to manage the time that they spend their campaign spending money, and by lumping it together as an aggregate cycle limit is not a significant increase, although it's a small increase, which we think is appropriate. Thank you.
Senator Limmer, then Senator Gazelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, I think you make my point pretty well. You're using your time before an election year to purchase campaign material. I drive through your district all the time. You know my father lives in your district. And I see your billboards up, but they aren't up all year round. They're up toward the end of the campaign where you want the focus of the voter to focus on the message. That's a smart thing to do. But you're using that year before to invest in that purchase. And now we're creating a longer timeline where now you can have 3 years to invest that amount of planning and money for that last few months of messaging. And so we really will be having in excess of $100,000 to $120,000 of that spending impact coming in at the last 3-4 months of the campaign. And as a result, that certainly will increase. It'll raise the bar on the sophistication of messaging and campaign tactics. It'll increase the messaging that I think most voters are sick of to begin with. at least in my district. I'll claim that. And then I think it also increases the influence of PACs and lobbyists and big money donors throughout the process of influencing the voter. I just think this dollar amount is just way too high.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Again, I guess I do the math differently, Senator Limmer. The increase here in that cycle is, which I think actually is too low, it just goes from $112,000 to $120,000 for senators. And, you know, the law allows people to make campaign expenditures 20% a year. What it has to be, however, is, as Mr. Goldsmith was saying, it's money out the door. I mean, these radio people that they want the money back from, they want to undo a contract. And, you know, in the purchase of my billboards, it's money out the door, the contract is signed, I can't get any money back. And so, again, I consider it just good planning. And the it is not a significant increase. And in particular, going back to the board's observations and evaluations, what this does is indeed allow more control over your campaign yourself as the candidate than the influence of outside entities to which money can then be diverted for independent expenditures. I would much rather have Senator Limmer in charge of his own campaign than other groups campaigning on his on behalf of him with an independent expenditure, or those groups that would like to defeat him. Seems like to me candidates are more in control of their spending, and contributions are sent more to them individually. Again, echoing the campaign finance board's position that we have a better system that is less controlled by outside interests that can collect unlimited amounts of money in an election, and I think it dampens the appetite for spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, even in a single Minnesota Senate race.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One comment and two quick questions for Senator Mr. Goldsmith. On Section 44, where it has the 3,000 limit, I hope we have software to track that, so that we know where we're at. But my questions on Section 46, on the very bottom, it talks about large contributor means an individual other than the candidate who contributes an amount that is more than one-half the amount an individual may contribute. I think that's $1,500 for a Senate large contributor. Is that in a cycle? So, in other words, if they in a cycle go over that, I believe, 1,500, then they fall into this category. Is that correct?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, that's correct. This is what we have referred to as the special source contribution limit, where large givers, lobbyists, and political committees and funds are lumped together, and you can't take more than 20% of your spending limit from that total group, and so that is correct.
All right. And Mr. Chair, next page, Section 47, where an individual can contribute up to $200, and we don't have to document the disclosure and reporting information. Is that per year, or does that now become per cycle?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, this actually refers to individual contributions that would be made in any time a contribution. First of all, let me back up. This is contributions from associations that are not registered with the board. So it's not contributions from individuals, and it's not contributions from party units, committees, or funds registered with us. This is these other groups that aren't registered, and right now they can contribute up to $100 per year And I think I will look at this to see if we specified that it's per election cycle, but we would intend it to be per cycle, that just raises to $200, which is what we've raised every other threshold to.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Goldsmith, well, tell me about the individual then. I mean, because if they exceed a certain amount in a year, we have to do reporting. How is it under this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, the itemization threshold still is on a calendar year basis, just like you report now, and it's raised from $100 to $200.
And finally, Mr. Chair, if this goes ahead, reporting in some ways gets a little more complicated, so I hope that we have good procedures in place so that we don't make mistakes.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, yes, my software team is already aware of these changes, and because of the way the software is built, it will not be difficult to start tracking aggregate limits over an election cycle and yet report appropriately in a calendar year using our software.
And Mr. Chairman, also that, you know, we do have now a requirement that except in hardship cases that you use electronic filing, which you know.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, how many candidates, do you have any idea how many state Senate candidates have spent anywhere near $112,000 in a four-year period under which you say they can do now? Do you have any idea? I can't picture two people in the Senate spending their 20% in the first year of their term and 20% the second year of their term and 20% the third year of their term. I understand what Senator Rest is saying, people spending that 20% the third year of their term. But do you have any track? Do you think anybody has come close to $112,000 in a four-year period?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I don't have those records here. Of course, we have them in our database, but I would agree with you that the numbers are going to be very small, because I also agree with Senator Limmer's point that people tend not to spend their campaign spending limit in the off years because it's ineffective to do so. You may be able to make use of something 1 year before the election year, but that 20% in other years is essentially wasted because people don't use it. And so what we really look at is most of that spending happening in the election year, and nobody gets the benefit of the true spending limit that's in statute now. We did have some elections that were near that level, and we had at least a couple of elections, which I think I brought with me, where independent spending in the elections exceeded $300,000, whereas candidate spending was in the $100,000+ range.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rester, Mr. Goldsmith, I think you just made there Mr. Senator Limmer's point that this is a huge increase. The fact that in theory one could spend 20% in each of the 4 years, and this is on campaign expenditures, anything you do with related to constituent service and other expenses, those are not campaign expenditures, and nobody is doing this. So saying it's right now 112 and we're only raising it a little bit. Remember, these are the limits for candidates who agree to abide by the limits. I mean, there are always a handful of candidates who choose not to, but in exchange for public money, this isn't really a limit. I mean, nobody spends that much, and the trouble is, as Senator Limmer pointed out, it's going to drive up the spending across the board. I don't think I'll deal with these today, but the contribution limits, that's $6,000 a couple can give to one of our campaigns. I understand that things have changed because the court rulings and such have opened up all this independent spending. And I don't disagree, Senator Rest, that I'd much rather have the candidates have more control over it than that. And I'm trying to be cognizant of the fact that there is that outside spending in a handful of cases. But I think the reality of this is saying that, I mean, we have not had double the limit of House candidates for 20 years. We've had the same contribution limits, and some, I'm sure, say that's way too low. But basically, you're saying that even with your much, much higher contribution limit, you could have, what is it? If a couple give $6,000, you could have not that many couples, 20 couples, make your entire contribution limit. And I think this is going the wrong way. I understand some modest changes, but Senator Rest, those contributions, the expenditure limits have been inflation adjusted. They do keep going up. They keep going up every year. And the other question I have, or question perhaps, when you change the itemized reporting from $100 to $200, I think it was Section 28.
It's throughout.
Yeah, okay. With Section 28, increasing the itemization thing, I've always had a problem. There are lots of people here at the Capitol who are paid to persuade us to vote certain ways. They would now be able to give us $200 without anybody ever knowing about it. I've always thought that if somebody is paid here to lobby us, they ought to have their contributions at least disclosed. What do you feel about the idea of requiring disclosure for those if you're going to raise it for everybody else to $200? Or do you think they should be $200 too, Mr. Goldsmith?
Just for the record, to Senator Marty's point, Mr. Goldsmith, maybe you can explain. There is not a way that 20 couples could contribute $6,000 to reach the limit because there's the aggregate contribution limit. So, Mr. Goldsmith, how would that really work?
You wouldn't get the public subsidy with it, of course, Senator Marty. So that's kind of a false argument, I think. They could give that, but you wouldn't. If you wanted the public financing, you'd be out of luck.
Right. That's true.
Senator Pappas.
The contribution limits apply to everybody without regard to the public subsidy, but if you wanted the public subsidy, you can only count the first $50.
Mr. Goldsmith, to that point.
Senator Bach, yes, and to your point, Senator, no candidate can take more than 20% of the total spending limit in large contributions, so that cuts everybody's limit essentially in half. Because you're going to reach that cap just like people get packed out under the current law. I did want to point out that we have three members on the board who have run for office, two former legislators and Mr. Lugar, who ran for, I think, a county office or some other office. And one of the things the board talked about was the fact that candidates are forever raising money. They have to raise $100 contributions in off years. They raise the election year limit in the campaign year, and they're raising money, and not out there campaigning. And the board did feel that by making this a cycle-wide limit and increasing the amount, that would allow candidates to raise the money when it works best for them and then to campaign during the election year.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, in that case, I think we should go back to the contribution refund program. I don't know if the governor put it in his budget, but I strongly think at least putting some public finance money in would be a smarter move than just upping the amount that people can get. And, yes, if you're right, by my math, I think it would be more like 40 couples could give you the entire $120,000 limit. And, yes, you wouldn't get any public finance money. I don't know that you'd need it then, though. But back to the $100 disclosure threshold, this would account for everybody. In other words, does the board have any – or Senator Rest, maybe you're policymaker here. Do you think that it's reasonable to to at least require the people who are professionally paid to persuade us to at least have to disclose their contributions to us instead of raising it from 1 to 200? I'm more open to the 200 if we're going to at least say that the people whose job it is to persuade us shouldn't be able to give it unitemized.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a particular feeling about that or opinion, but I can imagine that we might get challenged in court for treating the individuals and particularly different from based on their occupation, treating them differently under the campaign finance system. I think if I were a lobbyist, I would object to that mightily in terms of the disclosure. They are treated differently in terms of they're registered and they're part of the special source contribution so that they can't have more they can't have undue influence, and that all of the money that you raise for your campaign is not allowed to come from people whose profession is that of lobbying or political funds or whatever. But I don't know. Maybe the board has considered that. I'd be interested in their opinion.
Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, first of all, it wouldn't be a problem to actually do it. It could be done, and it could be done in the software. I would expect that if that's going to happen, that the $200 threshold should apply to individuals who are not lobbyists, and the $100 threshold should remain in place for individuals who are lobbyists, and also, in that case, for political committees, funds, and probably party units. I share Senator Rest's concern whenever you start treating different groups differently based on either occupation or political involvement, you have to ask questions about whether there will be an equal protection problem. I do think that we have a legitimate reason to treat lobbyists differently because they are directly trying to influence the legislators who they then are giving contributions to. So while we might get sued, I wouldn't be terribly concerned about that.
Mr. Chair, just one final comment. I think there are very many wonderful things in the bill and some that I think are reasonable, and I think there are about three or four things in here that are really problematic, however.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, does that make you a maybe?
Good question.
Mr. Goldsmith?
Just one final comment, Mr. Chair. For those members that are concerned about the cost of elections going up, they are going up. They already have gone up. You need look no further than the last election cycle to see that. The question is, whose money is going to be spent, who's spending it, and who controls the election?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest.
I wondered if you would consider that amendment just to delete those lines. That had
Mr.
That
Chairman, I'll move the
CE2
amendment.
Senator Pappas moves the CE2 amendment, which deletes lines on page 17 and 18. In favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to say something, but I think Mr. Goldsmith just summed it up, and it was really for Senator Limmer's purpose that I was going to say this, which is I take issue with what Senator Marty said, that nobody spends that much. The reality is that outside interest groups are spending that much. So it's down to who's going to spend the amount, the candidate and the campaign, so they can control it, Senator Limmer, or some kind of outside interest. So I kind of get that. Is that what we're where we're trying to move? And I also wanted to comment that I recall back in 93, I think you said, that the Senate originally wanted to have a higher limit, a contribution limit of $1,000 as opposed to the House having $500. Given the fact that we have larger districts, et cetera, we need to raise more money. And that was a compromise with the House to bring that down to $500. They would not tolerate us having a higher contribution limit. So had we had that $1,000 all these years, this would not seem like such a large increase.
Senator Newman, then Senator Fischbach, then Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to get us started, I'm going to offer the A15 amendment, and while that, and I would ask for a roll call vote, Mr. Chairman.
What's his amendment?
We'll get it distributed.
We need two copies here. We need two copies.
This is real easy to read.
Everybody have it? Senator Newman moves to A15. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the members of the Subcommittee on Elections, this is the same amendment that I had offered yesterday. So, you know, to the extent that that helps you. For the rest of the committee members, just a real brief explanation as to why I'm offering this amendment. If you go through Senator Rest's bill, you will find significant changes in the request by the board, which will significantly increase their jurisdiction in this area. And I will tell you that I agree with Senator Marty and I agree with Senator Rest that there are a lot of good things in this bill. And there are things that I do, in fact, support. But I want you to, I'm going to just ask you to keep in context some of the things that they are asking for, and that is, we've been talking about for quite some time now, the increase in the limits in campaign contributions. That's simply one of the things that they are asking for. They, in addition, are asking for a very significant change when we begin talking about the expressly advocating language that's contained on page 3 and the election engineering language that's contained in the bill. Not necessarily bad things. The thing that really got my attention is that this bill will provide that in investigations, the board will no longer make findings of probable cause, that is, a determination as to whether or not to proceed with an investigation and get a determination as to whether or not a violation has occurred. That finding of probable cause, in my mind, is absolutely appropriate. What I do not agree with is the request from the board to ask the legislature to give them the additional jurisdiction to make findings of fact, conclusions of law, and an order. And if you take into consideration the significant changes that are being asked for in this bill, and then in addition to that, give them, the board, the authority to determine the outcome of their investigation, I think that that is absolutely inappropriate. Now, let me put it in context for you as best I can by going to the expressly advocated portion of the bill. That's on page 3, subdivision 16A. I think that that provision, expressly advocating, is a good idea. And it's a good idea because we have got case law that says you have to use the magic words, i.e. vote for, vote against. But the board is now bound by the use of those magic words. That's really an objective test in my mind. What they are now asking you to authorize them to do is to go to the expressly advocating language where the board is going to have to determine with a subjective test, a reasonable person test, whether or not a violation has occurred. And so in the context of this bill, that's a bad idea because you're giving the board too much authority. And the same is true in when you get into the electioneering portion of the bill. So my objection to the bill isn't so much the additional authority that the board is asking for in terms of policy changes. My objection to the bill is that in addition to all of those things, we are now talking about allowing the board the authority to determine the outcome of their investigation, and I think that's inappropriate. I think rather, for instance, under Minnesota Statute 211B, OEH has got the authority to make those determinations in a contested findings, in a contested case where they make findings, and that to me is appropriate. So all I have asked that the authority to make a determination as to the outcome of the board's own investigation be transferred over to an independent fact finder. And I don't think it's appropriate to allow the board to determine the outcome of their own investigation.
And that idea was met with resistance. So I am offering this amendment because what it does is it strikes the expressly advocating language and it strikes the electioneering language, a language that I think under different circumstances where the board isn't the fact finder is a good idea. And that is the that's the purpose of the election or the amendment. Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call vote.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, we did have this amendment in the subcommittee. It was thoroughly discussed and it was defeated. I oppose it. And with regard to, and I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Goldsmith to give a more thorough rationale. But once again, the language that we use for expressly advocate comes directly from a United States Supreme Court decision, Wisconsin Right to Life versus the FEC. And this is the language of the majority opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts. Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I want to address Senator Newman's concerns, and I had hoped to meet with him before now, but between yesterday and today, neither of us would have had time to do that. First of all, just a minor quibble. The board isn't asking for this. These are recommendations. The board thinks these are good policy, and if you decide that you agree that they're good policy, you will put your trust in the board to implement that policy. I want to speak about a couple of provisions that Senator Newman has alluded to and explain why they're in the bill, because actually this bill doesn't change the way things have been done for 35 years. And in those 35 years, I think we have had one or two decisions appealed to the Court of Appeals and one appealed to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Otherwise, those people who have been the subject of board actions have been satisfied that their rights have been protected. On one of the concerns I think that Senator Newman seems to have is with lines 4.31 and 4.32, which says that after the filing of the complaint, the board must make a public finding of whether there's probable cause to believe a violation has occurred. And we changed that to say findings and conclusions and require the issuance of an order. The reason we do that is because the board, throughout the statute, is already given the ability to impose civil penalties. That's nothing new. Look at each violation provision, and it says the board may impose civil penalties. The board does that by order. But the board, and I as an attorney, not the board's attorney, but an attorney, have always been concerned about the statutory threshold of probable cause, which for lawyers in the group, you'll know that's a very low threshold. It's the most minimal showing that can be used in a criminal hearing just to go forward with a trial, and it's not typically used in the civil sense as it is here. I'm concerned that if the board actually applied such a low threshold and then imposed civil penalties based on that low threshold, we would have a constitutional problem because the level of proof that's really needed for civil penalties would not have been met. So the intention of this is to raise the level of proof that the board would have to find before civil penalties are imposed. As a matter of actual application, that's what the board does already. And if you go back and look through numerous documents resulting from complaints and board investigations over the years, you'll find these things styled differently. Sometimes they're called findings of fact, sometimes evidentiary findings, sometimes conclusions. But the same result is that we apply essentially a preponderance of the evidence standard before we issue a civil penalty. So that really is not intended to change the way the board does things, but to recognize the elevated level of proof that we already require. Secondly, with regard to Chapter 211B, the board is suggesting that three provisions of that chapter be given to the board as they relate to Chapter 10A candidates, and those are the prepared and paid for disclaimer, the corporate contribution prohibition, and the use of campaign funds. Those are all areas that we're already dealing with in 10A. We have the independent expenditure disclaimer. We have use of campaign funds through non-campaign disbursements. And we always get questions about how those funds can be used. So by giving what Senator Rest was saying, we answered the questions already. There's nobody else that can answer your question about Chapter 211B. If you call the OAH, they can't help you unless there's an opinion on point, because they're an adjudicative body, not an administrative agency. And so we handle these questions all the time. The problem is we can't give an authoritative answer because we don't technically have jurisdiction. We can't issue an advisory opinion, and we can't draft an administrative rule. And so it's, we believe, a service to the people who are calling us on a daily and weekly basis that we be given the authority to answer their questions with some authority. Finally, as I alluded to, board decisions can always be appealed to the Office of Administrative Hearings or directly to the Court of Appeals.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Insofar as Mr. Goldsmith's statement regarding advisory opinions, there is nothing in my request to ultimately change the decision-making findings over to OAH that would preclude the board from issuing advisory opinions. As to Senator Rest's comment that the language in the express advocacy portion of the bill coming from the Supreme Court, I agree. That is not the issue, however. The issue is who is going to determine whether or not express advocacy has occurred. And my objection isn't to the use of the determination language from the Supreme Court. It's rather allowing the board to make that subjective call. I want to specifically bring to your attention the fact that while the board is making a claim here that, you know, this really doesn't change much, I want to urge you to go into the bill and look at some of the civil fines and penalties that they are asking be allowed to impose. There was one in there for like $10,000. I mean, that's a felony level fine. And the additional penalties, fines, jurisdiction, you know, the things that they're asking for here in terms of authority just seems to me to be not reconcilable with a checks and balances system. How can we honestly say that the entity that is conducting the investigation of an alleged violation is the proper entity to make the call as to whether or not a violation has occurred, especially when we are now going to, in effect, lower the bar to the subjective standard that the Supreme Court of the United States has imposed? That's my objection to this bill.
Senator Rest?
Two things. There's no $10,000 penalty in the bill. It's $1,000 where it has been. The board currently can make these findings, and as Mr. Goldsmith has said, only on three occasions has there been an appeal made beyond their findings. And in the last, 35 years? So I think they have a pretty good track record of treating people and entities that come before them fairly. And for the most part, I think we hear that their decisions are reached by through consensus more often than not. I think, first of all, get the facts right. But then I believe that what we're proposing here is reasonable, and their findings can indeed always be appealed. It is not the final say-so. If someone wants to appeal, they have a couple of different routes to do that, and with consequences for the board if the appeal is upheld. And I'll turn it again to Mr. Goldsmith for further comment.
Mr. Goldsmith?
What Senator Rest says is correct, and the one thing I didn't mention is that under the current law, if something is moved to the OAH as a contested case, that would be at the board's expense, so this can actually be done without cost to the aggrieved party.
Any other discussion on the A15 amendment? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I do like this expressly advocating. I had written on here before you were trying to remove it that I thought it was better than the previous language. And your concern is simply that you think the board enforcing it, I guess I think the fact that it can be appealed, I mean, if the board had the final say, I'd have a lot more concern about it, but I think the fact that you can go to OAH and the courts, I don't know. I just think that that was actually an improvement in the bill.
Senator Newman.
Very, very briefly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Marty, I agree. I agree that the use of the magic words, all you have to be is somewhat of a wordsmith to step around that prohibition. And using the express advocacy language will prohibit misconduct. I agree with that. And I also agree, certainly, we have the right of appeals to go to the Court of Appeals and go to the Supreme Court. Those are avenues that are always available to us. But just as Mr. Goldsmith has indicated, it's a rare bird when anybody appeals the decision of the board to the next step. And that's just human nature. I mean, you could try 100 cases, and you might get one that gets appealed. That's because people accept the findings. That still doesn't address my concern, my ultimate bare concern of the lack of the checks and balances. And this is true, and you're going to hear me talk about it and have heard me talk about it. It's true with all state agencies. I don't represent state boards and state agencies. I represent people. It's the people that are being hurt by this provision that allows the fact finder to be the entity that investigated the alleged wrongdoing. That's my point.
What do they do now?
On the Newman motion to adopt the A15 amendment, roll call has been requested. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bach?
No.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Fischbach?
Yes.
Senator Gazelka?
Yes.
Senator Hahn?
Yes.
Senator Limmer?
Yes.
Senator Marty?
No.
Senator Metzen? Senator Newman?
Yes.
Senator Pappas?
No.
Senator Sieben?
No.
Senator Skoy? Senator Stumpf?
No.
On a vote of 5 in favor and 6 no, the amendment is not adopted. Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, actually the electioneering portion was what I was going to ask about because there's a page and a half or almost 2 pages, and I'm trying to figure out who is it not going to – the electioneering communication does not include – and then there's all these requirements. What are you aiming at? Who are you trying to exempt? What is an example of an exempt communication here?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fischbach, I'm going to let, again, Mr. Goldsmith go through the details. But the things that are exempted are things like nonprofits' use of voter guides. There was a lot of discussion with them about that should not be considered an electioneering communication. And again, what that does is doesn't say you – it's no prohibition about doing them. It's just that they aren't need to be disclosed. There's a disclosure requirement if it is done within – with the exemption of the voter guides – if it is done within 30 days of the primary, 60 days of a before the general election, with an additional exemption of 10 days following a legislative session, so it is a disclosure issue. And now I'm going to let Mr. Goldsmith go into the details of the procedures that would qualify something as an electioneering communication and then the circumstances beyond the time period stuff where it would not, you would not need to disclose.
Mr. Chair, just as clarification, that's what my understanding is,
yes,
that this, when it does not include this, that it does not have to be disclosed. And I'd like to know who you're aiming at,
yes,
and who's exempt here. So that's what you can focus on if you want.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, thank you.
Let's see. And we want to be looking then at page 16 as he goes through it.
Mr. Chair, actually, I find it on page 17 where the beginning, the electioneering communication does not include.
Okay, but it starts with section 33 is what I'm.
And Mr.
Which
Chair,
started
Senator
on
Rest,
page,
I understand that. I'm really focused on.
Yes. And now it starts at section 33, and then he's going to explain, starting at 1717, what it does not include, which means if it doesn't include it, then you don't have to disclose.
And that's, and,
okay,
and Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, that's what,
yes,
I'm interested
I get it,
in.
Yeah.
Who's exempt?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, with your permission, I do need to go back to the definition because, first of all, before it's included, it has to be one of the things in the definition. And what are excluded from the definition itself are websites and electronic communications. So from the beginning, websites and email are always excluded because they're simply not the type of communication that could ever be an electioneering communication. And then I can go on to the exemptions. So what we're talking about then are radio, television, satellite, so broadcast-type materials, printed materials, signs, billboards, and telephone calls. So besides the time exclusions, we had conversations with the various organizations and the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, which represents 501c3 corporations, and also some of the interest groups pointed out to me that they do a voter guide, and it's a nonpartisan voter guide under IRS regulations, which means a 501c3 can do that. And so section 4, or part 4 on line 17.25, and the subsequent provisions describe that nonpartisan voter guide, and both the Council of Nonprofits and the 501c3 that I worked with agreed that that would exclude their voter guides. Now, a voter guide is different in some respects than a legislative scorecard, which becomes more editorial and opinionated, but a true voter guide would be excluded. Also, there were concerns by these groups that they distribute material in lots of ways. They give material to churches. They do county fairs. They have lots of events. They have it in waiting rooms at different places. And so through the use of the definition of distributed to the electorate, which appears, let me find it here.
32.
Yes, at 18.32, we limited the print materials so that materials distributed in any other way other than by lit drops or direct mail into the district are excluded. So distributed at a county fair, in your office, to your groups that you meet with, through churches, those materials would be excluded. And beyond that, there are thresholds for the number of copies you have to distribute into the district and the cost of those materials. But those are the main exemptions. Of course, it has to identify a candidate clearly and be made within the prescribed time frame.
Senator Fischbach, anything further?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Goldsmith, I'm just really, is it only the 501c3s that we're trying to get at?
Oh.
Or who, I guess who else? Because there's a lot of, you know, if it does this and answers this and, like, the questions are clear, the description of the issues are clear and unbiased. Who decides if they're unbiased? But that's a whole other issue. But there's, you know, there's so many little things that it just really looks like it's really aimed in particular. And I'm just, if it's just the 501c3s.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Goldsmith, the 501, Senator Rest, the 501c3 question.
Recall that the board, although it can do its own review It mostly functions because a complaint is brought to it that this wasn't a true voter guide. It wasn't a nonpartisan true voter guide, that it did all these other kinds of things. And that and so, therefore, it's not that it couldn't be sent out. There's no prohibition about that. It just says that if it doesn't meet those criteria, then it is indeed an electioneering communication, and you have to disclose. That's all. That's what it does. It doesn't say, it's no prohibition about doing it at all. You can do any of these kinds of things, but again, if it comes 30 days, 60 days, 10 days after the session, it is it would be considered an electioneering communication. We give the exemptions, but it would be considered an electioneering communication, and the only requirement then is disclosure. And if I got that wrong, Mr. Goldsmith can correct me. That's plain language.
Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, to the direct question about 501c3s, it's my understanding from working with the groups that we talked to that because of the exception for nonpartisan voter guides, we should never see a 501c3 in our office because this is what the IRS says they can do, and we've described, actually, according to the Nonprofit Council, we've described it in broader terms than the IRS would allow. The IRS might be more restrictive, but we've described what they do within their 501c3 status. So it would be my understanding that a 501c3 would never be involved in electioneering communications if it was acting consistently with what it's allowed to do under IRS regulations. To the group that groups we're really looking at, I think they will be 501c4s, c6s, unions, and that is those groups that avoid the magic words. They also avoid express advocacy under the new definition because the form of their communication takes the form of a piece that says, call Senator Rest and thank her for her vote doing this that helps the state, or call Senator so-and-so and tell them to stop doing this. These communications appeared in the last election cycle during those 30 and 60-day periods before the election. And it's those communications which are not express advocacy because they would not fall within the no other purpose definition. Their purpose certainly could be to influence how a legislator thinks. Those are the other quote-unquote loophole in campaign finance disclosure. And so we would have a statement of attribution as to who prepared and distributed those, and also then disclosure of the costs and sources.
Senator Stump?
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, actually, to that exact point,
Senator
but
Fischbach,
I did have other
point.
Questions, or should I wait for another
ahead,
round?
Go ahead. Senator Fischbach, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I'm just curious about the language on page 31, 31.24 through 31.27. It's obvious that it's directed at a situation that happened this last election cycle. And I'm just curious if that's, first of all, that kind of situation has ever happened before, and second of all, does this mean that we will be paying the subsidies will be distributed twice? Because if you meet the certain requirements, the old candidate, for lack of a better term, I don't know, the withdrawn candidate may have already received their subsidies, and if they meet the requirements to keep the subsidies, they would be able to keep that in their campaign, and then we would be reissuing these subsidies, so we'd pay twice.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, Senator Rest is right. It's not our intention to pay twice, and Senator Fischbach, you're correct. This is a result of the court putting somebody on the ballot at the last moment. The board doesn't feel strongly about this, and if it was appropriate, it could certainly be removed. Let me say that we're struggling with that question now, and we'll struggle into next session when we make a recommendation, and that has to do with the language about vacancy in the nomination, because it's essentially the same thing. What happens when there's a vacancy in the nomination? What if somebody's been paid? What if it's after the primary, before the primary? And so we are struggling with this, and I think that that was put in to cover one particular situation and is not a strong recommendation.
So, Mr. Chairman, so Senator Fischbach, that your question was not with regard to cash contributions as opposed to in-kind contributions, but lines 24 through 27 specifically. Is that right?
Yes. And Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, and potentially it's not the intention necessarily to pay the subsidy twice, but it could happen.
Mm-hmm.
It could, because you, if the withdrawn candidate has met all those requirements, there's nothing that would compel you to have him return that, or him or her to return that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
We could do without that if Senator Fischbach would move to delete 3124 through 3127, since that's really only happened once, and there is no intention to pay the subsidies twice.
And Mr. Chair, I would make that motion, 31 through 24.
And I would support
31,
that.
24.
Senator Fischbach moves delete lines 31.24 through 31.27. Any discussion? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Stump?
Mr. Chairman, just a clarification on you said that the internet is excluded, and what's all in, included in the internet? Is it texting and email and actual internet ads?
And Facebook, web pages, et cetera.
Okay. So how do you, so that's a distinction between telephone, even
doesn't include telephones either.
It doesn't include telephones either?
No, it does.
Yeah. Oh, it does. I'm sorry.
It does.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to offer the A-16 amendment, please.
Have it. Senator Hahn moves the A-16 amendment. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, and Senator Rust, this goes back to an earlier question that I was raising on Section 49 of the bill on page 29 and 30. And essentially what the amendment does is reinstate the stricken language on the bottom of page 29 and the top of page 30 that restores the options that currently exist with respect to how donors may be, their donations may be reported, their contributions may be reported in the General Treasury of an association. And as I understand it, the changes that the bill would make reduce those options to only one. And what this would do is just restore the existing options that exist. And I guess in the course of the discussion that we've had on this, it seems to me that the bill as written would potentially have a negative effect on individuals' willingness to participate in making contributions. And there may be, I don't know if there's, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but there may be some infringement on their ability to freely participate in the process. So I would just ask that the amendment be adopted and restore the current structure of the law.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I would oppose the amendment. I think in Mr. Goldsmith's explanation of the options that were there, the first one was never used by anybody, so it's not really an option. And I think that the board has set the bar extremely high And that I think what we've seen in court decisions is that it can't be unreasonable. And it seems to me that setting that at $5,000 with the impact of it really being a $50,000 contribution that could go without disclosure is very reasonable. And we did move those bars from $1,000, which, you know, conceivably in, again, these days of extremely expensive campaigns where we're addressing that in the contributions, et cetera, and the expenditures, that this is a setting it at $5,000, and then this pro rata system is a one that we should endorse that the board has done, and I hope you'll vote against the amendment.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask for a roll call vote.
Roll call's been requested. Any other discussion on the A-16 amendment? Mr. Goldsmith?
Go ahead.
Just to reiterate what I said before, really the question is whether there should be any disclosure of underlying sources from these groups that are making independent expenditures, or should there be disclosure? Under the current law, effectively, there is no disclosure, and the bill would provide that disclosure.
Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bach.
No.
Senator Cohen. Senator Fischbach.
Yes.
Senator Gazelka.
Yes.
Senator Han.
Yes.
Senator Limmer.
Yes.
Senator Marty.
No.
Senator Metzen. Senator Newman.
Yes.
Senator Pappas.
No.
Senator Sieben.
No.
Senator Skoy. Senator Stump.
No.
Being five yes and six no, the amendment is not adopted. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump.
Senator Rest, how does the language coincide with the language in the one of the other bills that's coming up this, in the state government's section relating to the campaign finance board? Don't really know.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, I don't know to what you're referring.
Well, I'm just wondering if Article 3, which relates to campaign finance, in the state government's, I would assume it's the governor's proposal. Is that close to what you have in your bill?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stump, there's no appropriation in this bill, but after the bill goes to judiciary, it will be referred to the Finance Committee and to the State Government Finance Division, and at that point, Mr. Goldsmith would be preparing a fiscal note. But the it's my understanding right now that the impact of this bill with regard to the budget request from the governor, it would have very minimal impact.
Okay.
Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 6-
Chair, roll call.
Senate 661, as amended, be recommended to pass. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, as I said, I think there's some good things in the bill, but I'm very troubled by some of the others, and I'll take a look at that. I wish I was on Finance Committee, but I'll take a look at them before the floor and hope to discuss some with you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I would invite any members on any of the provisions to have a conversation with Mr. Goldsmith and to get more of the backgrounding of why the board came up with this proposal to start with, and I'm happy to meet with you as well. But on some of the details, Mr. Goldsmith is just a wonderful source of information and background, and I hope you will seek him out.
Senator Seidman renews her motion that Senate File 661 will be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
As amended.
As amended. Mr. Roll calls. Yeah. Roll calls been requested.
I'd like to move that, change the motion to a move to forward it without recommendation. That's a higher motion, I think.
To judiciary.
To judiciary. I'm on judiciary. Environment?
You can make that motion.
The first vote would be on Senator Marty's motion that the bill be referred without recommendation. Any discussion on that? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary, no. The motion prevails. On Senator Seidman's amended motion that Senate File 661, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Judiciary without recommendation. Still need a roll call, Senator Gazelka?
Yes, please.
Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bach?
Yes.
Senator Cohen?
Yes.
Senator Fischbach?
No.
Senator Gazelka?
Nope.
Senator Han?
No.
Senator Limmer?
No.
Senator Marty?
Yes.
Senator Metzen? Senator Newman?
No.
Senator Pappas?
Yes.
Senator Seidman?
Yes.
Senator Skoy?
Yes.
Senator Stump?
Yes. On a vote of 7 yes and 5 no, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest, thank you. Senator Eakin, what do you have for us today?
Awesome.
Something we've already voted on, I think.
Yep. So it's language that's already contained in Senator Rest's bill.
Senator Seidman moves Senate File 496. Any discussion on these technical and conforming changes?
Mr. Chair, could we have a brief description of what the bill does?
Senator Eakin, can you tell us what the technical and conforming provisions are?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer. And this is a technical bill. It takes some of the non-controversial provisions that were in the bill that you just heard. We're moving it along as a separate bill. And it just has clarifying language in here. It removes redundancies and unnecessary language. Address some things, oversights that had been made to make sure that the law, for instance, applies to lobbyists as well as to candidates, some of the late filing fees, things of that nature. I do have Mr. Goldsmith here who can answer detailed questions about the specifics if you have any questions.
Senator Limmer, would you like more?
Yeah. Senator Han said it eliminates my Senate district. I have no further questions.
Any other discussion? Members, this Senate file came to us from the subcommittee, and it was not amended there. So the contents of Senate File 496 is the subcommittee report that's in front of the Rules Committee. On the Seidman motion to adopt Senate File 496 as referred from the Subcommittee on Elections. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Oh, it's the floor. I'm sorry.
It's going straight to the floor. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senator Eakin, you're on the Senate floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I think that concludes our business for today, members. This committee's adjourned.
So did you go through all the other stuff?